Okay, so hopefully everybody found a JSI to turn their problem sets into. So one just point about problem sets, or actually more about problem set solutions. I do not post problem set solutions. However, your GSIs will have them. So if you really want to know the answers to the problem sets, you need to go to discussion section over the next couple of days. And they will cover them there. So today, we want to extend our conversation about savings and investment. So recall that what we did last week with consumption and savings and the desired savings and investment function, one of the assumptions we made was that we were working with a closed economy, one in which there was no international trade. So today we want to relax that assumption and open it up to international trade and international financial flows, just to see, make it more realistic, but also to see how that will change the situation. However, before we do that, we should talk a little bit about some of the economic news that came out. Last Friday, as I indicated last week, the Labor Department was going to report on the employment situation in January. And what the Labor Department told us was two things. One is that based on the payroll employment survey, a survey of businesses, they found that 20,000 jobs had been eliminated in January. However, they also told us that on the household survey, a different survey, they found that the unemployment rate, the percentage of the labor force that was unemployed but actively seeking work, also declined to 9.7. The first number, losing 20,000 jobs, didn't come as a surprise to very many people. The big drop in the unemployment rate, however, did. So one of the questions that people have gone back to and thought about a lot over the weekend is whether or not we've seen the peak in the unemployment rate at 10.1% last fall, or whether or not this drop that we saw in January was just an aberration. My own guess, and it is a guess, I'd like to think that it's an informed guess, but maybe not, is that it was indeed an aberration, and that over the next month or two, we'll see the unemployment rate go back up again. But we'll have to see. What I also think is likely to happen is that now that we only lost 20,000 jobs in January, just put that in context. January of a year ago, we lost almost 800,000 jobs. So we're losing many, many fewer jobs now, which is part and parcel of the turnaround that we've seen in the economy. As the second headline says, signs of hope as the jobless rate falls. But still mixed news. The outlook is uncertain. People are still questioning what's going on. There was also a very interesting article that was pointing out that on average, a person who finds who's been unemployed and then finds a job has been unemployed for more than 6 months. And so even after they do go back to work, what they find is that they have financial issues, obviously. I haven't been working for 6 months. So that's probably put them into some sort of financial stress. But in addition to that, there's also some psychological distress, having lost a job when very worried about losing their job again. And there are also many, many psychological kinds of issues that come up when you lose your job. Because many of us find that our sort of, at least a portion of our self-esteem happens to be involved in our jobs. A couple of other things that happened. Global markets shudder on fears of government debt crises. So we'll talk about this in much more detail late in the semester about how much of a budget deficit in total accumulated debt can governments run before it becomes very worrisome. We know in the short run that governments can run very large budget deficits without any significant long-term consequences. But we also know that if you run substantial budget deficits for extended periods of time, that there are, in fact, long-term consequences, and most of them are not good. So in this particular case, there are great fears that Greece, the country of Greece, may in fact have to default on its outstanding debt. Now, Greece is a very small country. It has a population that's less than the size of the nine-county San Francisco Bay Area. And it has 300 billion euros in sovereign debt. Sovereign debt, that's just government debt of Greece. And it also has a budget deficit that, as a proportion of the economy, is about 12 or 15%. So people are very, very concerned about whether or not Greece will be able to continue to meet its debt payments as it's continuing to have to borrow more and more money to finance the government. Wait and see. Today, people seem to be much more encouraged about that, and we actually saw the stock market up at 200 points at one stage. Of course, that still leaves us down about 7% for the year. I mentioned last time that the White House was talking about how to double U.S. exports over the next 5 years, something that I think is incredibly ambitious. They did unveil a plan. I haven't seen the details of it yet, but we'll have to take a look at that. And again, we'll talk about international trade in more detail later in the term as well. We also talked a little bit about some of the shoe issues between the European Union and China. And how the European Union had decided to put what are known as anti-dumping duties, basically taxes on imports of Chinese shoes. And the Chinese said, well, that's not playing fair. And so not only are they going to retaliate by putting their own anti-dumping duties on other things, including U.S. chicken products, but also they're filing a complaint with the World Trade Organization. What we're seeing here is an escalation, actually, of trade tensions between China, between China on the one hand and the European Union and the United States on the other hand. Trade disputes, especially if they escalate to trade skirmishes, to trade battles, to trade wars, are never a good thing for either national economies or global economies. We won't look into that so much in this course, but if you're particularly interested in that, at some point you would want to take Econ 181, which is international trade. Okay, so today then, as I said at the top, what we want to do is expand our discussion of desired savings and desired investment for an economy that's open so that we have both imports and exports as well as the financial flows that go back and forth associated with those. We'll start talking about the balance of payments accounting, because a lot of this is accounting, unfortunately. Then we'll come back and talk about goods market equilibrium and how that equilibrium is different when we have an open economy versus a closed economy. And then we'll talk about either small economies or large economies and how all of that works out. So here's a table of the balance of payments accounts. You probably can't see it very well, but this table is in your textbook, so it's not all that important that you actually be able to see either the line items or the numbers that are here. I do, however, want to point out that in this table of accounts, we can actually draw a line right here. And so what you should notice is that this top part is something that's called the current account. The current account. And the current account is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily net exports, imports and exports. So it's the flow of goods and a few minor items back and forth. Below this, we have something that is known as the capital account, or actually it's called the capital and financial account. The capital and financial account is essentially how we finance the current account. So the current account's measuring the dollar flows primarily of imports and exports going back and forth, and what the capital and the financial account, especially the financial account, incorporate is the money that goes back and forth to pay for those imports and exports. So that's the important thing to look at in this table. You could look at also the size of the numbers because they're also quite significant. We always make a distinction between credit items and debit items in the balance of payments. Credit items represent receipts or money flowing in, and debit items are going to reflect money flowing out. It's very important in balance of payments accounting to remember which way the money is flowing. So let's think about the credit items. So again, the credit items are going to be funds, money or funds flowing into a country. So when we think about the money flowing into the United States in terms of international transactions, though that money flowing in is for, generally speaking, one of four major purposes. The first purpose is to buy U.S.-made goods and services. That is, these are our exports. So when we send our goods and services abroad, sell them to a foreigner, they've got to pay for them, so money will be coming in. So exports of goods and services are a credit item. The second one is what we call investment income on foreign assets owned by domestic residents. So this is the dividends or the interest payments or the profits that you might receive for having previously, that is in some prior year, invested abroad. So if you were to buy a mutual fund that invested in Brazilian companies, or if you were a company and you had built a facility, American company, and you had built a facility in Europe, or if you had bought Greek government bonds, you might not get your payment back, but as long as you did, notice that all of those things are foreign assets. They're foreign assets owned by U.S. residents, domestic residents. So again, the interest, the dividends, the profits that are associated with those previous investments, that flow of return is what we call investment income. So again, the money's coming in. We also have transfers to domestic residents. So a transfer is just money coming in for which you didn't have to do anything for. So if your spouse were living abroad and sent you money, that would be counted as a transfer. If you had been, for instance, a German, a person working in Germany, covered by a German pension plan, decide to retire in the United States, your money would be flowing into the United States as your pension plan money came in. That's also considered a transfer payment. For the United States, both investment income and transfers are relatively small flows compared to exports or the final column or final row, which is net purchases of domestic assets. Now, these are purchases of domestic assets by foreigners. So what they're going to be buying is U.S. stocks and bonds and maybe a factory or land or something that is an asset in the United States that a foreigner will own. Now, this purchase of domestic assets by foreigners will eventually lead, presumably even in the following year, to investment income for the foreigners. Okay? So this is where you actually buy the asset. The flow of dividends, interest, and profits later will be leaving the U.S. and going abroad. So this category of net purchases here is going to actually end up as investment payments on the debit side in the subsequent year. Now, before we go there, let me just point out, and again, we'll do this in more detail later, these credit items essentially represent the demand for the domestic currency. Well, the demand for the domestic currency in this case, if we're thinking about the U.S., is the U.S. dollar. So if we thought about this in the context, again, of international trade, these credit items reflect the demand for U.S. dollars in the foreign exchange market. The demand for U.S. dollars in the foreign exchange market. So these are the dollars that foreigners want to accumulate because they want to make one of these four transactions. They either want to buy the things that we make, the assets that we have, or they need to make interest payment or investment payments or transfers to U.S. citizens. Now, on the debit side, it's just the opposite of all those items. So on the debit side, one big debit is our imports. So we, as U.S. residents, when we buy foreign-made products, the oil comes in, the dollars have to flow out. So because money is flowing out, that becomes a debit item in the balance of payments accounts. The second one is investment payments. So again, these are just the interest, dividends, and profits that foreign owners of U.S. assets have earned. So when China invests in U.S. government bonds, the U.S. government makes its interest payments, sends a whole bunch of money to the Central Bank of China. That's an investment income, an investment payment. The Chinese own domestic assets, that is U.S. assets, and the Chinese are obviously foreign residents. We could also transfer money to foreign residents out of the United States. And then finally, there's net purchases of foreign assets by domestic residents. So when you decide as an American resident to buy a mutual fund that invests in emerging markets or even in European markets, or you buy government bonds that are issued by other countries, or as a company you buy physical assets or build physical assets, those are all purchases of foreign assets that you are acquiring. Again, the money has to flow out in order to make that purchase. So again, these are all the flows. Now remember, this flow of assets goes out as a debit item when you purchase the asset. The return on those assets, the profits, the dividends, the interest income, comes back as an investment income, that is, as a credit item. Although the credit items, of course, are generally much smaller than the debit items. So this is money that's going out. Now, when it leaves the country, it typically goes out as U.S. dollars. So as it goes out as U.S. dollars, most other countries don't transact their consummate their transactions in dollars, but rather in Japanese yen or euros or British pounds or Chinese yuan or whatever their own domestic currency might be. So in essence, this is a big supply of dollars into, once again, the foreign exchange market. So we could think about these debit items as the supply of the domestic currency, in our case, the U.S. dollar, into the foreign exchange market. So the balance of payments, because it has all of these credit and debit items in them, we can add them all up and figure out what the net balance is in terms of supply and demand in the foreign exchange market. Now, I said that we could divide the balance of payments into the current account, the top half of the, or top quarter of the table that we had before, and the capital and financial account, which is the bottom half. It actually turns out that there are three accounts. These are the two that we worry mostly about. And those three accounts are the current account, the capital and financial account, which I mentioned, and finally, there's something that's known as the official settlements account. We'll come back to the official settlements account in just a few minutes. So we can look at each of these in a little bit more detail. So the current account is simply the sum of net exports, net income from abroad. So we could think about net income from abroad in this case as our investment income minus our investment payments. So that would be basically our net factor payments. So all those flows of dividends and interest and profits, once we net them all out, give us the, and then add all these guys together, we've got our current account. Now, it turns out that for most countries, that both net income and net transfers are very small. And so, by and large, the current account approximates the net exports. Just give you an idea, in the United States, net exports are 98.5% of the current account, which obviously means almost all of it. Now, there are exceptions for some countries, but by and large, we can ignore net factor payments in net unilateral transfers. But if we look at these a little bit more detail, we can see, again, we're talking about net exports. So we're talking about exports minus imports. So a credit item, exports, money flowing in, minus the imports, which is our money flowing out. So that gives us our net export side. Net income from abroad is our investment income minus our investment payments. Again, as I mentioned, that's for most countries, that's relatively small. And net unilateral transfers are just transfers in to transfers out. Again, for most countries, it's fairly small, but for some countries like Mexico, the Philippines, Turkey, South Korea, it can be more substantial. When transfers are more substantial for a country, it's typically because a large share of their workforce is actually working outside the country, working somewhere else and sending money back home. So the current account then can be thought of as just the sum of these guys, and there can be either a surplus or a deficit. When we have a current account surplus, more money is coming into the country than is going out. So if we've ignored for a moment net factor payments and net unilateral transfers, what that means, if more money were coming in than going out, is that exports would be greater than imports. So a current account surplus would be the same thing as a net export surplus. Current account deficit would be just like a net export deficit. So again, if we know which way the money's flowing, we're in pretty good shape. Okay, now, the capital and financial account actually has two components in it. The capital account, which we mostly ignore because it is net unilateral transfers of real assets, which doesn't happen all that much. But that's the transfers here. Most of the capital and financial account is actually the financial account. So it's exchanging the ownership of financial assets between foreigners and domestic residents and things like stocks and bonds. And that captures, again, generally more than 90%. Okay, so as I said, the capital account is net unilateral transfers of assets in or out. Again, we generally don't, that's generally a fairly small number. The financial account is the one that we care more about. And it comes back to those net purchases of domestic assets by foreigners. So remember, that would be money coming in, a credit item, foreigners buying stocks, bonds, physical assets in the United States, minus what U.S. residents are purchasing abroad, which is a debit item. So as U.S. residents buy foreign stocks, bonds, and real assets, money will be flowing out. So we want to look at those differences as well. Now, within the capital and financial accounts, we sometimes make the distinction between two types of investment flows. It doesn't really matter whether we're talking debit or credits here, so domestic residents buying foreign assets or foreign residents buying domestic assets can fall into either one of these categories. But when they are physical assets that are involved, buying a factory, buying land, something like that, then we refer to it as a foreign direct investment. Now, one always has to be careful about what foreign direct investment means. U.S. residents can make foreign direct investments in foreign countries. Foreign residents can make foreign direct investments in the U.S. So foreign doesn't tell us where it's coming from or where it's going to. So here's an example, though. A foreign firm buys or builds domestic capital goods. So that would increase the financial account balance. Portfolio investment has to do with only financial assets, buying securities, stocks, bonds, other types of financial assets. So we think of that as portfolio investment. So we'll see Thursday and next Tuesday that it's sometimes important to make the distinction about, is the asset a real asset, a productive asset, or is it a financial asset that doesn't necessarily increase our ability to produce goods and services? So we'll need to make those distinctions as well. Now, the official settlements account. The official settlements account essentially tells us what a country's central bank is doing in terms of international transactions. What a country's central bank is doing in terms of international transactions. This will tell us a lot about whether or not a country has a floating exchange rate, a country like the United States or Western Europe, the Euro region, Switzerland or the UK or Canada or Australia, versus a country that has a managed or a fixed exchange rate, like Japan or South Korea or China or Saudi Arabia. The way that we can tell is that countries that have flexible exchange rates see very little movement in the official settlements account. It almost does not change. While countries that manage their foreign exchange rate or fix their foreign exchange rate typically see big changes in their official settlements account. They're either accumulating what we call foreign exchange reserves or they're losing them. So the fact that China, for instance, has gone from basically zero foreign exchange reserves 15 years ago to over $2 trillion today is one indication that the Chinese are managing their exchange rate. The fact that over that same 15-year period, the official settlements account balance for the United States is virtually unchanged, as it is for the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of Canada, tell us that those central banks, by and large, leave the determination of their exchange rates to the market. So that's what this official settlements account balance is really telling us. We see most of those official reserve assets in foreign government securities. So in China's case, for instance, they have $2.1 trillion of foreign exchange reserves, with about 60 or 65% of that invested in U.S. Treasury or federal agency securities. So you can feel good that on those three-month Treasury bills, we're paying them all of 5 or 6 basis points per year right now. So not a great investment for them, great investment for the United States. It could be in bank deposits or what are known as special drawing rights at the IMF, something that China would like to use more of because they don't really want to hold as many dollars, but they don't also want to accept the consequence of not holding the dollars, or they can hold it in the form of gold. Again, we'll talk about the official settlements account and the implications of having floating and fixed exchange rates much later. The official settlements account is sometimes actually also referred to as the balance of payments. And it is simply the changes in the domestic government's reserve assets minus the change of foreign central bank holdings of domestic assets. So it's a combination of what both sides of the equation are doing. Again, you can have a surplus, which means you're increasing your official reserves, or a deficit, reducing your reserves. Now, I'm not going to say much more about the official settlements account until later in the semester when we talk about international trade and exchange rates much more directly. We do, however, want to talk about the current account and the capital and financial account. So remember that the current account is primarily imports and exports. So we measure it by the flow of goods and services. And the capital and financial account is basically the money flows that come about to finance it. It turns out, as an accounting identity, with a few sideline assumptions, that the current account and the financial and the capital and financial account must sum to zero. Every transaction must be paid for, is an easy way to think about that. This is the current account tells us the transaction, the capital and financial account tells us the payment, which also says that the current account is equal to minus the capital and financial account. Notice that what that means is if the current account is in surplus, the capital and financial account must be a deficit. And if the current account is a deficit, the capital and financial account must be a surplus. That will be important for us in just a few minutes. Now, in reality, of course, especially in very large economies like the United States, adding up all the numbers from different sources never comes out exactly that way. So we actually also can measure a statistical discrepancy. In the actual measurement of most economic data, we can triangulate. We can measure most things from more than one direction. And by being able to do that, that allows us to see where we've mismeasured one or more of the variables. And so that becomes very helpful here as well. Okay. We might also be interested and knowing about what our total net foreign assets are. So remember, we had within the capital and financial account net purchases of foreign assets by domestic residents, or net purchases of domestic assets by foreign residents. So we can net all of that out. But what we really want to know then is, what is the sum total? Are we a net, do we have net assets, or do we have net liabilities? So that could become very important. These net foreign assets, of course, is just the sum of all those flows that have taken place in all previous years. So what we're talking about is looking at our total foreign assets and subtracting out our total foreign liabilities. Now, these assets can change for two reasons. One is we can have the acquisition or disposition of assets and liabilities. Again, net purchases or net sales on both sides. The other way that it can change is the value of an asset or the value of a liability can change. We haven't bought anymore, but the market value has changed. So we can get those changes as well. And that's important. If we look further, we can talk about a net increase in foreign assets. The increase only is the current account surplus. If there's a decrease in net assets, it's equal to the current account deficit. So remember, the current account surplus would tell us that there's a capital and financial account deficit. That means there's more money flowing out of the U.S. The money flowing out in the capital and financial account is acquiring foreign assets. So the current account, the financial and capital account, are linked by that identity that their sum must equal to zero. And the cumulative total of the current account, or for that matter, the capital and financial account, will also tell us what our net foreign assets or our net foreign liabilities will be. So it turns out that approximately, this is what, 2010, so 20 years ago, roughly around 1990, the United States was the largest net, had the largest net foreign asset position in the history of mankind, history of womankind too, the history of every kind. So the United States had made huge investments abroad over the years. We had also seen foreigners invest in the United States, but on a net basis, the U.S. had made substantially more investments abroad than foreigners had made in the United States. Today, the situation's completely reversed. We, the United States, has the largest net foreign liability position that any country has ever had, and is substantially larger than the size of our net foreign asset position was back in 1990. I mean, larger by five times larger. So the U.S. as a country, in part because we have been running substantial current account deficits, means that we've had a decrease in our foreign assets, net foreign assets, so substantial that net foreign assets are now net foreign liabilities. Okay, so if we keep all of this in mind, we've talked about several different concepts here, and there's a relationship between most of them. The current account balance, or the current account surplus, let's just stick with surpluses. The current account surplus, as we saw, is also a capital and financial account deficit. Okay? So surplus here, deficit here. That also means that we are acquiring foreign assets, and that suggests that we are lending abroad. So I want to tease this out a little bit because it's a very important point. A country that has a current account surplus, so we're exporting more than we're importing, also has a capital and financial account deficit. Deficit meaning more money's going out than is coming in. The money going out is being invested in foreign assets. So the investment in foreign assets, at some point, though, that investment has to be paid back. So that investment or that purchase of a foreign asset is like a loan. So Let me give you a very concrete example. China runs a very large current account surplus. They export more than they import. So they receive a lot of foreign money. Their financial account, in particular, is a big deficit. So what China receives, though, primarily from the U.S. and from Europe, is a whole bunch of dollars and euros, which, of course, can't be used very well in China. So what China does with those dollars and euros is buy government bonds of one sort or another from the United States and from European governments. So China has this big stack, hopefully sitting in a bank, with big walls, barbed wire around it, big stack, $2.2 trillion worth of foreign currency deposits or investments in other types of foreign securities. Well, those are just loans to the U.S. government or federal agencies or the European governments, and we have to pay them interest, and on maturity, we have to pay them back. So a current account surplus allows you to do net foreign lending. Net foreign lending. Now, of course, it works just the opposite. If you're running a current account deficit, then you end up having to borrow money from foreigners. You will have net foreign borrowing. So the current account tells us something about the capital and financial account, but it also tells us whether a country is engaged in international lending, net foreign lending, or borrowing, net foreign borrowing. And of course, as we said earlier, a current account surplus is really the same thing as a net export surplus if we assume that net factor payments and net unilateral transfers are zero, something that we will assume. Okay, so we've got all these different kinds of terms for that from accounting perspective are exactly the same. So we use these, we can use these interchangeably, but mostly we want to use them in the context of what we're talking about. So let's see how this can make a difference in terms of our savings and investment identities. So once we have an open economy, national savings is now given by total amount of savings in the country. That'll equal our investment plus our current account. Now remember, the current account is net exports plus net factor payments plus net unilateral transfers. But let's just make it simple and say these are zero, as we've said down here. So notice that if we do that, then we can now talk about national savings being used, or changes in national savings being used in one of two ways. It can change investment activity, or it can change net foreign assets. Okay? Remember, the current account will tell us something about what's happening to net foreign assets. So if we save more, we can either invest more domestically or we can acquire more net foreign assets by lending money to foreigners. Now, we can take this equation and come back to our desired savings and desired investment equation. And now what we've got is desired savings equals desired investment plus net exports, or the current account, which also shows us that desired investment is our savings minus net exports, or the current minus the current account. So again, this shows us a relationship that how desired investment must be financed. Desired investment must be financed by either borrowing domestic savings, that is desired savings, or by borrowing money from foreigners through a current account or net export deficit. Now, we could also continue to rearrange this, and what we see then is that our net exports, or our current account, is just the difference between desired national savings and desired investment. So if you think back to what we did last week, remember we had a bunch of things that would change desired savings, or a bunch of things that would change desired investment? Well, now notice that if any one of those things change, we're also going to have an effect on net exports. Has to happen. So net exports of the current account is also going to be driven by the very same factors that we looked at last week that will influence desired savings and desired investment. So let's take a couple of cases. The first case that we want to look at is what we call a small open economy, or an SOE. Now, a small open economy, small and open mean very specific things in this context. First of all, let's just talk about open. So open economy means an economy that's very open to international trade and financial flows. And a small economy simply means an economy that is so small that regardless of what happens to desired savings and desired investment, it cannot influence the world interest rate. The world interest rate. By that definition, most countries in the world are considered small economies. They're not all considered small open economies, but most countries in the world are actually considered small economies. The United States is not. The Euro region is not. Japan is not. China is not. Once you get beyond China, though, you begin to find very few examples of sort of medium-sized economies. Okay, so too small to affect the world interest rate. That's what we're talking about. Notice, in some sense, what we're saying is that this small country is like a perfectly competitive firm. So if you remember from micro, in a perfectly competitive firm, the firm itself is a price taker. No matter how much it produces or how little it produces, it cannot affect the market price. Same thing that we're talking about here. This economy is so small, no matter what its desired savings or desired investment, it will not influence the world equilibrium interest rate. Again, most countries would fall into this particular category. Now, one of the implications of this is that the small open economy can borrow or lend any amount that it wants at the world interest rate. Okay, so whatever the world interest rate is, I can be a net borrower or I can be a net lender. I have no influence on that world interest rate. Okay, so here's an example of, let's suppose that this is the our small open economy. And let's just suppose that this is also the world interest rate. So notice that at this particular point, if it just so happens that our domestic interest rate, R0, was equal to the world interest rate, we know that desired savings equals desired investment. And at this stage, we also see that the current account is equal to zero. There is neither net foreign lending nor net foreign borrowing. So Shakespeare likes small open economies whose domestic interest rates equal the world interest rate. For he once said, neither a lender nor a borrower be. Oh, well, he did. Okay. Now, let's think about what it would look like for a country to be a net lender. So notice that
if this economy were closed, there were no international transactions, we would be right here. We would be at an interest rate of R naught. Desired savings would exactly equal desired investment. Country is very hunky-dory. Now, if we open the economy up, suppose that the world interest rate is up here. So at a world interest rate above the domestic equilibrium, closed equilibrium rate, so this is our world interest rate. Notice, once we open up the economy, remember our assumption about small open economies. We can borrow or lend as much as we want at the world interest rate. So as a saver in this small open economy, I no longer have to invest at R naught. I can actually invest my money abroad and get a higher interest rate at the world interest rate. So desired savings are going to increase. Out to here. But remember, the money's being invested outside the country. So for domestic companies who want to borrow money to make investments with, I actually have to pay a higher interest rate too. R naught is no longer available for me to be borrowing at. Some of the domestic savings have gone out of the country. So in this case, desired investment will also fall. So what we see then is that desired savings is greater than desired investment. And from our equation, this implies that we have a current account surplus. And the size of that surplus is the difference. And with a current account surplus, this means that we have net foreign lending. So what we see happening in this country is now that we have higher interest, we're saving more, but we're investing less. So what do we do with all that excess savings? We lend it abroad. By lending it abroad, we will be purchasing net foreign assets and in subsequent years be getting investment income from that. So whenever, in an open economy, whenever desired savings is greater than desired investment, the current account will be in surplus, and the country will be lending abroad. Just the opposite would be the case if the world interest rate were below our domestic closed interest rate. So notice that in this case, once we open the economy up, interest rates fall. Why do they fall? Well, foreigners are saying, wow, that small open economy, they've got high interest rates there. I'm going to invest some money in that country. So as money comes flooding in, it will drive the domestic interest rate down to the world interest rate. As interest rates fall, desired investment will increase, and desired savings by domestic residents will fall. Now notice that at the New World interest rate, desired investment is greater than desired savings. And this implies a capital account deficit or a net export deficit. Well, wow, look at this. We're investing out here, but we're only saving here. So all of this amount in here, the difference between that, the excess of desired investment over desired savings, still needs to be financed. If we can't finance it from domestic sources, we've got to borrow it from foreign sources. So here, then, we've got our current account deficit of that amount. And, of course, this also implies that we have net foreign borrowing. Okay. Now, neither the U.S. nor China would be considered small open economies. They are large economies. But if we were to think about what's happening in each one of those countries, this is more similar to what's happening in China. At the world interest rate, China saves a lot more than they invest domestically. So they need to do something with the excess savings. Those excess savings get cycled abroad, lent out to countries like the United States and the European Union. In the United States, just the opposite is the effect. We don't save enough to fully finance the desired investment activity that we want to undertake. And so we need to borrow some money from foreigners. Where we borrow the money from is those countries that run current account surpluses. So you can always think about countries with current account surpluses as being lenders, net international lenders, and countries that run current account deficits as being net international borrowers. That, by the way, is true whether you're a small country or a large country. Now, we've set the equilibrium position. Now we can think about an economic shock inside a small open economy. Now again, don't attach too much significance to the word shock. I don't mean shock as a big surprise. A shock here just means some change in a variable that will affect either desired investment or desired savings. So it's one of those things that's going to shift our two curves. So notice what we have here. We're still with our small open economy. Let's fill in a little bit. So in this small open economy, we start with desired savings greater than desired investment. So that means then that this difference is our current account surplus. So we've got a current account surplus, so we already know that we're a net foreign lender. Okay. Now, what we want to think about is what happens if something occurs that leads to an increase in desired savings. So we can think about that as an outward shift. Of the desired savings curve. Now remember, this is a small open economy, and what we mean by small here cannot influence the world interest rate. So interest rates are not going to change in this particular case. So we're stuck at our world interest rate, which means that desired investment will stay the same, but that desired savings will increase. And what we can also see is that the current account surplus has gotten bigger. So in a small open economy that starts with a current account surplus and then has an increase in desired savings, will also increase the current account and also increase net foreign lending. So we could say then that an increase in desired savings implies an increase in the current account, which implies an increase in net foreign lending. Now, I showed this for a country that already had a current account surplus. You might want to work through what would happen if we started with a current account deficit. And you also might want to think about how this would work if there was a change in desired investment rather than a change in desired savings. Again, I've set it up so that we start with a current account surplus. You might also want to work it so that we have a current account deficit initially. So there are lots of combinations and permutations that we might see here. But rather than going through that here, let's now move to the notion of a large open economy. A large open economy. So, as I mentioned earlier, there are a number of large open economies in the world. The United States is clearly there. The European Union is clearly there, or the Euro region. Japan might be there. China and Japan are pretty, I would say, are pretty close to being there. But the list really begins to fall off after that. So typically, what we assume with large open economies is that there are only two economies in the world. So this is really easy to think: the U.S. and everybody else, or the Euro region and the rest of the world, or maybe Japan or China in the rest of the world, or we could think of those two countries as being the only two that matter. So we'll have a home or a domestic economy, and we'll have a foreign economy as well. So what we'll see now is that large economies can affect the world interest rate. And they need to affect the world interest rate in a way that the current account surpluses of the surplus countries is exactly equal to the current account deficits of the deficit countries. Now, in our case, because we're only assuming two countries, it means one country will have a current account surplus, the other country must have a current account deficit. And the deficit country's deficit will be exactly the same absolute size as the surplus's country's surplus. If it's not, the interest rates will change. So we can think about that in this context. So we're looking at two large economies with the very insightful names of home and foreign. And we have their desired savings and desired investment lines. So notice that before they were, we would think of them as open economies, we might see that in home, our interest rates would be relatively low, where in the foreign country, the interest rates would be relatively high. So why would that be the case? Well, all we're talking about is differences between desired savings and desired investment. Relative to whatever their desired savings are, our foreign country has a very high desired investment curve. Our home country, again, relative to its desired savings, actually has relatively low desired investment. Consequently, foreign has a high domestic interest rate, home has a very low one. So now, let's open it up, and these countries can trade with each other and throw money around. I always like it when they throw money around, especially when they throw it in my direction. Doesn't happen very often, but that's why I like it. Okay, so what would happen here? What do you think would happen between these two countries? So think about, suppose that you're a saver in home. So you're sitting here thinking, oh my goodness, I'm only getting this really low interest rate, R-naught in home. Now, once I open it up, I go, wow, I can invest my money in foreign and get their really high interest rate. Just the opposite is happening. In foreign, companies are borrowing initially at a very high interest rate. Once we open it up, they go, wow, I could borrow money from home at a much lower interest rate. So savers in home will be motivated to push their savings to the foreign country, where businesses in foreign will be motivated to borrow money in home. So what we end up with then is natural pressures that are putting upward pressure on home's interest rates and downward pressure on foreign's interest rates. Now, we happen to know that where this pressure will stop is going to be where the interest rate, assuming no transaction cost and all those other simplifying assumptions, where we're going to end up is where interest rates are exactly the same in both countries. But if interest rates are going to be exactly the same in both countries, then home, which will have excess savings, notice that as the interest rate rises in home, desired savings increase and desired investment falls. So home has excess savings that they'll be lending abroad. In foreign, falling interest rates reduce savings and increase desired investment. So in foreign, we have excess desired investment or excess demand for loanable funds. The only equilibrium situation is where the interest rate is the same in both countries and the excess savings in home are exactly equal to the excess borrowing in foreign. They're the only two countries, so you can only lend the amount that wants to be borrowed. You can only borrow the amount that can be lent. So if I can eyeball this right, that's a pretty straight line. It is, by assumption. Okay, so notice what happens. In home, as the interest rate rises, desired savings goes up, and desired investment goes down. This difference, then, is the current account surplus in home. In foreign, the interest rate is falling, so desired investment goes up. And desired savings goes down. So here we want to be borrowing. So this then becomes foreign's current account deficit. And as we said, the current account surplus at home must be exactly equal to, within measurement error anyway, the current account deficit that we have in foreign. Both countries will be looking at the same world interest rate. Home will be lending. Notice we have a current account surplus. So we also have net foreign lending. And foreign has a current account deficit, so we have net foreign borrowing. Okay, now this is a much better example of our China-US example that we used before, with the US having the current account deficit and doing a lot of foreign borrowing, and China having a current account surplus and doing a lot of foreign lending. Notice, if you're lending, you're acquiring net foreign assets, so China's net foreign assets should be rising, they are, and the US is borrowing, so their net foreign assets should be falling, or their net foreign liabilities should be rising, which again is exactly the case. So this is kind of an initial equilibrium situation where the current account surplus in home is exactly equal to the current account deficit in foreign. Once again, we could ask, what happens if there's something that changes either desired investment or desired savings in either country or both countries? Oh, that would be fun. For an exam. Okay, so here we are in So this is our initial situation where we have home with a current account surplus, foreign with a current account deficit. Now, what happens here if, let's suppose that there's an increase in desired savings at home. So in this case, the desired savings function shifts out. Notice that immediately at the original world interest rate, that the total amount of savings in home increases, so the current account surplus would increase as well. Meaning that at home, we're now trying to lend more abroad. As we try to lend more abroad, what will happen? The world interest rate will now begin to fall. And so what do we see? Ultimately, as that world interest rate falls, now remember, desired savings shifted out, so we know the initial effect is an increase in desired savings, but then as the interest rate falls, desired savings is going to shrink a little bit, down to the blue savings line, but investment, desired investment will increase a little bit, And what happens to the current account? Still have a surplus, at least the way that I've drawn it. They get bigger or smaller? Well, let's see if we can't figure that out. Let's go over and look at foreign. So if we look at foreign, notice that the world interest rate fell, right? So the important, the critical point here is recognizing that the world interest rate has to fall. Home is now saving more money, so there's more money saved in the world at the world interest rate than is being demanded for investment. So there's an initial increase in desired savings in the world relative to desired investment. That will push the world interest rate lower. In foreign, where nothing happened, we see that that lower world interest rate will lead to an increase in desired investment and a decrease in desired savings. So we can see that in foreign, it must be true that the current account deficit got deeper. So this implies an increase in net foreign borrowing, which means that over here we have to have an increase in net foreign lending. Which also tells us that our current account surplus increased at home. Okay. So notice, even though you might not be able to tell from the way you've drawn, shifted the curves, it's still possible to figure out exactly what must be taking place here. Okay, you might also want to try this with things like maybe a decrease in desired savings, if you don't fully understand this, as well as a change in desired investment or in one, or maybe some combination of things happening in both countries. So there's a lot to work with in terms of these types of diagrams. Okay, on Thursday, we're going to shift to a long-term model of economic growth and standards of living known as the solo growth model. So you want to make sure that you read that chapter because it can get complicated, but I'll make it easy.